and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And this is Tux Lerzel.
Unbelievable. We come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many still very much out here doing its thing, and we like to acknowledge that. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Fuck yes.
We be drinking. Tux already be swearing.
It's a new year and a new me.
Yes. And I'm scared.
We're drinking a fancy frosty cocktail here, a very boozy frosty cocktail. My story today is from the 1860s and 1870s. So the cocktail we're drinking today was actually created in 1857.
Okay.
It's called the Prescription Julep. And cocktail historian David Wondrich says that it is one of the tastiest mint julep recipes he knows.
Okay.
That's a big endorsement.
How many other julep recipes are there?
There are actually quite a few.
Okay.
In Jerry Thomas's book.
Here I thought there was one.
Yeah, exactly. So the difference between this recipe and the one that most of us already know, the mint julep,
yeah,
which we had in episode 4 of this show, is that rather than using bourbon whiskey, this recipe calls for a mix of cognac and rye whiskey.
Oh, okay.
Wondrich says that this combination is, quote, a marriage made in heaven, the cognac mellowing the rye and the rye adding spice to the cognac. So today, most of us tend to think that the mint julep made with bourbon is the only one and only way that a julep can be made. But back in the julep's heyday in the mid-1800s, there were tons of variations. Basically, you can use any spirit you want to make a julep.
What?
Early cocktail recipes were a lot less specific about certain spirits. It was basically like, it was a julep because of the other things that went into it.
Okay.
But you could use whatever liquor you want. In Jerry Thomas's book, there's like 6 different julep, and it's like gin julep. Same recipe as before, but substitute gin. So along with whiskey, very common ingredients are brandy and other types of whiskey besides bourbon. Gin was even used. Even fortified wines like sherry or Madeira could be used. I feel like that would be very sweet because you're adding sugar to a julep anyways. The one thing is the main core of it is the crushed ice. You have to use crushed ice. And generally, most recipes call for mint to be muddled with sugar.
Okay.
But Jerry Thomas even has a recipe for a pineapple julep.
What?
It has pineapple, orange juice, and gin. And I think there might be raspberry syrup, but it's just over crushed ice. And I think
really crushed ice is the thing?
Yeah. It's like an adult snow cone. It's a very boozy adult snow cone.
Yeah.
So this recipe, the prescription julep, it actually comes from a sort of tongue-in-cheek medical joke that was made in Harper's Monthly, like a magazine, in 1857. They had this serial in the magazine called A Winter in the South. And in this one edition, a Dr. Quackenboss, Dr. Quackenboss writes out a prescription in Latin medical abbreviations that is essentially just a julep recipe.
I love that. That's really funny.
Yeah. Translated back into English, the prescription calls for white sugar, spring water, strong cognac, spirits of rye, mint leaves, and powdered ice.
Powdered ice?
Yes. At the bottom of this prescription, he makes a recommendation for dosage. Quote, repeat dose 3 or 4 times a day until cold weather.
Ha! Until cold weather?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Julep is a summer drink.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Quackenboss MD.
I love that doctor. I'm obsessed.
Wondrich recommends in his write-up on this recipe that you use good old cognac. Because cognac is the main base spirit, you want to use something quality.
Mm-hmm.
But he says there's no reason to splurge on the rye because the rye, you don't use nearly as much rye. And it's really just there to spice up the cognac. He also recommends, this was not how the original recipe was written, so I didn't do this. But he recommends that just before serving, you float a little bit of aged Jamaican rum just on top, just like a splash.
Okay.
Like this cocktail isn't boozy enough. So essentially, all this cocktail really is crushed ice with a little sugar and mint muddled together.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of it is pure booze. It's very any julep recipe is a very strong cocktail. One thing to note when you're making a julep, you know, you're supposed to muddle the mint into the sugar, but you don't actually want to like completely bash it to bits. A lot of times you'll see mint juleps with like little flakes of mint that have been sort of shredded in.
Yeah.
But really, ideally, you just kind of want to press the muddler into the mint leaves. You want to release the mint oils into the sugar a little bit, but you don't want to bash it to bits because it makes the mint a little bit bitter. Mm. So there should be whole mint leaves in your drink, not like flakes. But other than that, it's very simple to make and quite pretty.
It's really pretty.
And the crushed ice makes the drink really frosty. Like the glasses are completely frosted over from all this crushed ice. The powdered ice, yes. So let's take a little sip here.
Let's take a cheers. Oh, cheers. Icy.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Oh, that's delicious.
Right?
It smells so boozy, but it's very drinkable.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's because it's so cold.
Yeah.
You don't even really taste the booze at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all booze.
Yeah, all I taste is sugar and mint.
Yeah.
Ruh-roh! Pray for me. It's so cold that I wish I had like a sleeve for it.
Yeah, for the glass.
Yeah.
Totally. There you go.
I DIY'd a sleeve, y'all.
With some tissues.
It looks horrible. This will not be on Instagram. This looks like a mistake.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So I guess I should get into my story.
I guess. I'm going to be over here drinking this.
I know.
So good.
It's so good, right? So last season, Stephanie told us about a Civil War era field order that promised 40 acres and a mule to newly emancipated Black Americans. This field order made it into Section 4 of the Freedmen's Bureau bills. But as we know now, things didn't really work out the way they were supposed to.
What?
So while I definitely did not know all the details to that story at all until Stephanie filled us in last year, I had at least heard of 40 Acres
and a Mule. Yeah, same. I didn't know the details until I looked into it. And I thought it was just like a myth. I mean, I didn't know that it was written down on paper.
Yeah.
And that actually happened for some people on these islands in South Carolina.
We were field testing it. I was like, no, this is too good. We can't let this happen.
Yeah.
So I'd at least heard of it. I'd also heard of the Freedmen's Bureau. But today I want to talk about something that was created at the same time as the Freedmen's Bureau, but something that I had never heard of before in my life. The Freedmen's Savings and Trust Company, also known as the Freedmen's Bank or Freedmen's Savings Bank.
Uh-oh.
Have you ever heard of this?
I have heard that there was a Freedmen's Bank, and I think something bad happened.
Yes. Okay. Well, we're talking about it today, so you know something bad is coming.
Yeah, that's true.
So in 1865, in an attempt to make banking services available to former enslaved Black Americans in the South, the government created a bank specifically for the needs of Black people. Things went very well at first, with almost 100,000 people creating accounts in a few short years. But not surprisingly, a bunch of rich old white men got involved.
This is like Reconstruction?
Yeah.
Yeah. Classic.
Yeah. And in less than 10 years, the whole thing fell apart.
Less than?
Yes.
Yikes.
Yeah. So I would like to propose a toast.
Yes.
Raise a frosty glass.
Yes.
With your tissue sleeve.
Yes. Raise a glass elegantly covered in
draped.
draped. Yes. Cheers.
Cheers to teaching American history in history class.
Oh God. Oh, could you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never.
I know. Even though American history makes some people uncomfortable, future generations need to learn the truth to understand why things are the way they are today.
Yeah.
I actually just watched this video that came up on my on Instagram. I think I sent it to you. I'm not sure if you've seen it yet. This woman was speaking at a school board meeting and was saying, like, I have struggled with depression and mental health, and I have a therapist. And the first thing you do when you talk to a therapist is talk about your past and your history and the things that are traumatic in your past that lead to what you're dealing with today, and then goes on to use that as an example of why we need to teach about our past so that we can understand the trauma that we're experiencing today, where it comes from.
Yes.
Obviously, we need to put an end to this ridiculous pretend war on critical race theory, because critical race theory is not being taught in grade school. Critical race theory is like a college level.
It's only taught in law school.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Graduate studies.
There's all these anti-CRT bills in all these conservative states.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard about Wisconsin, all the things that they're banning.
Oh, my God.
It's scary.
Yeah.
You can't say the words patriarchy. Diabolical, what they're doing.
Oh, Lord. I can't. Yeah. Basically, parents just don't want their kids to feel bad about what white people have historically done to black people in this country. But that doesn't mean that you get to just, like, not teach history in history class in school. Children need to learn American history so they know where we came from and why we are where we are.
And maybe they'd have a little empathy if they learned the truth.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Sorry about that long-ass preachy toast, but it needed to be said.
It's in honor of Black History Month.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to take another.
Yeah.
I need to loosen my jaw gums, wet my whistle.
If you had, like, Heidi in closet, that you could do the whistle.
Yes,
that she does.
Soft and silky. So at the end of the Civil War, the economy in the South was a total disaster.
This drink is a perfect distraction from the horrors of this story.
Yeah, don't. Luckily, I have plenty of crushed ice left if we need another. The economy was a total disaster. Not surprisingly, things were even worse if you were black. Very few banks would service black people, and so they had very little access to the financial resources or capital that they might need to try to improve their lives, to buy homes, to start businesses, put away savings.
Exactly.
These resources were not available if you didn't have a bank that would let you in the front door. Many men, after being freed by the Union Army, were actually paid to join them. As the army was coming along, they were like, come on, we'll pay you, come with us. And a lot of them were also given cash for enrollment, which is sort of like what we would consider a sign-on bonus today.
Okay.
But obviously, while these men were enslaved, they hadn't had access to cash, and their white enslavers hadn't taught them anything about financial literacy at all. So to many people, the idea of trying to have cash and manage your cash and have a budget was a completely, totally new concept, and they didn't really know what to do with their money once they had it.
Mm-hmm.
Enter a white abolitionist and congregational minister named John W. Alvord. In his humanitarian work during the Civil War, he worked firsthand with black Union soldiers, and so he knew that these men had no safe place to deposit their cash.
Yeah.
In January of 1865, Alvord met with more than 20 philanthropists and business leaders in New York, and they sat down because they wanted to explore the idea of establishing a savings bank specifically to benefit these black soldiers.
Uh-oh.
Alvord told the group that many black soldiers were still receiving back pay from their army service, and since many of them had no experience managing their own affairs, they were often either squandering their pay, like using up all their money before their bills came due or before they would get their next paycheck. Or a lot of them were also being taken advantage of by swindlers.
Yes.
Who, you know, people saw these people coming with big stacks of cash and were like, I'm going to get my hands on that.
Yeah.
So Alvord wanted to establish a bank that would assist freed black Americans in their savings, their financial development, and integration into the American economy. Now, this was not the first time that somebody had tried something like this. Alvord's plan, it was going to be on the largest and most organized scale, but he got the idea in 1864 from several Union generals who had also seen the need for banks for black soldiers and created their own military savings banks.
Mm-hmm. God forbid they just let them bank with everyone else.
I mean,
the rest of the citizens.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Yeah, no.
Especially in the South. It just wasn't going to happen.
No.
So they knew
they
had to find a solve for
this. No, in the South, they'd be like, okay, I'll take your money. And it's like, wait, can I have it back?
Yeah.
No,
that's ours now. You gave it to us. Yeah, exactly.
Bye.
Yeah. So there was one of these like military savings bank. They were just in one location. It was like one general in one area would set up a bank for their soldiers.
Okay.
There was one in Louisiana. There was one in Beaufort, South Carolina. Mm. There was another one in Norfolk, Virginia. And Alvord saw these banks and was like, they're doing well. They're mildly successful.
Okay.
But he saw them as temporary measures and believed that a permanent savings bank was needed that would also cater to black civilians, not just soldiers.
Oh, okay. Yes.
So he was like, this is what we need to do. And this group that he was meeting with, they were like, you know what? You're right. Let's do this. Voted overwhelmingly for this plan and decided that a charter should be secured from the federal government to make this happen. So in February of 1865, with the help of our good buddy, Senator Charles Sumner, love him.
Yeah.
They brought a bill to incorporate the Freedmen Savings and Trust Company before Congress, along with another bill that was meant to establish a social services agency for recently freed enslaved people that would be known as the Freedmen's Bureau. Okay. These went before Congress basically at the same time, mm-hmm. and were brought by Charles Sumner. So on March 3rd, 1865, just over a month before his assassination, President Lincoln signed the Freedmen's Bureau legislation into law, along with, quote, an act to incorporate the Freedmen's Savings and Trust Company. Not only would the bank cater to freedmen and their descendants, but the plan was also calling for the bank to offer employment opportunities for Black people.
Oh, that's amazing.
Giving them hands-on training
yeah.
and experience with banking skills. Mm-hmm. Along with covering operating costs, the deposits that the bank received were to be invested in, quote, stocks, bonds, treasury notes, or other securities of the United States. And the charter suggested, quote, no loans would be made. And, quote, all the assets of the bank were owned by the depositors in proportion to the deposits of each. A board of 50 trustees was established. All white men.
Oh, God.
Yes.
Okay.
50 old rich white men.
Let me guess. They were in the banking industry.
Yes. Except for John Elvard himself.
Okay. Everyone else is speculating.
Yeah. He served as president, John Elvard. So he wanted to see this bank thrive and succeed. And his one of 50 hearts was in the right place.
Yeah.
So the short-term effects of being properly banked, to having access to a bank that would service you, mm-hmm. Included raised incomes,
yeah.
accumulation of wealth, mm-hmm. Land ownership,
yeah.
and even a rise in literacy levels, because bank paperwork was written. You had to find a way to read it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It also allowed people to smooth out the seasonality of farm work, because they were able to build up a cushion in the busy months mm-hmm. to get them through the slow months.
Okay.
Historians kind of believe that this was at least partially because limitations were placed on how much money could be withdrawn from the bank at one time. So bank customers were basically forced to save. Mm-hmm. Seemingly, this was done for that reason. It was done to sort of teach people how to save and what savings really meant. But of course, it also led to problems later
yeah.
on. Yes.
That's a lot of money that the bank is holding and can play
and
with.
And you're not allowed to take it out. You're allowed to take out a little bit, but not all of it at once.
Yeah. yeah.
So to encourage deposits and convince the Black community that their money was in safe hands, the bank created these bank passbooks, which were essentially like a checkbook where you're keeping track of mm-hmm. the money like that's ledger. Coming in and out. But the bank was sort of in charge. You brought it in. And the bank would note how much was being taken out. So it was all very official, but you kept your passbook.
Okay.
They also had these promotional pamphlets with slogans and poems on, quote, on temperance, frugality, economy, chastity, and the virtues of thrift and savings. And these materials leaned heavily on the bank's trustworthiness and congressional oversight. Mm-hmm. Marge Simpson groan is grumble, the appropriate grumble, groan.
Yeah. Yes.
Depositors were constantly being reminded during public meetings and other bank-sponsored gatherings that the bank was under the charter of Congress, thus under its complete protection.
Oh, no.
One writer later wrote, "Small wonder that most freedmen never knew that the only power Congress had over the bank was the right to inspect the books if it wished, which it didn't."
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
What a gag.
Ad campaigns and marketing materials included names of prominent government officials, often to the point of misleading depositors into believing that deposits were backed by the federal government, which they were not. They were not.
They were not?
One article published in Louisiana said...
Were banks not just backed by this time?
Not yet, no.
No bank was.
The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation,
oh, yeah,
the FDIC,
yeah.
didn't exist until 1933.
Oh, that's right. After the stock market crashed for the millionth time.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
The Great Depression, yeah. So one article published in Louisiana said that there is, quote, there is no possibility of loss for the reason that the government of the United States is responsible for every dollar deposited.
Lies.
This was a lie, a bold-faced lie.
Wow.
And the Freedmen's Bureau was also helping to publicize this bank, and this close relationship with the Bureau made it look like the bank was operated as a government institution.
Was the Freedmen's Bureau government?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But the Freedmen's Bank was set up by Congress, but it wasn't being run by Congress. It was a private corporation.
What's the point of setting it up?
They just like said, like, make it happen and then let business control it. Let bankers control it.
The market will provide.
Exactly.
Don't you know?
Yes. So this was a private corporation with no government guarantee. And like I said, the FDIC wasn't set up until 1933, so no deposits were insured or guaranteed at all. Believing that their deposits were completely safe because they were being told that their deposits were completely safe. Almost 100,000 Black Americans from a wide variety of backgrounds and occupations opened accounts with the Freedmen's Bank. The vast majority of deposits ranged between $5 and $50, but people could open an account for as little as a nickel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, a nickel was
more
than a nickel today, but So many depositors were receiving wages for their labor for the first time in their lives.
Yeah.
And owning a bank account was a huge source of pride and excitement for these people, that they were not only being paid for their work, but they were like hardworking, upstanding members of society who had savings accounts and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they were already hardworking, but yes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, they were harder working than
everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. The depositor most sought after by the Freedmen's Bank was the Black Union soldier. The back pay from these soldiers made up.
Oh, because they got like the most money probably.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And the back pay from these soldiers made up most of the first deposits in any new branch that opened.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
That makes sense.
Black Union soldiers buoyed these banks in the beginning.
Because the government was forced to pay their wages.
Yeah,
as
exactly.
opposed to just like some average Joe Schmo who's just like, I'll give it to you next week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Many of the bank's branches, when they chose new branch locations, were chosen specifically because of a large Union soldier population, Black soldier population.
Yeah.
So between 1865 and 1871, the Freedmen's Bank opened 37 branches in 17 states.
Wow.
Making it one of the first multi-state banks in the country.
Are they employing Black people?
Yes. By 1870, nearly all of the bank's branches, all of them, were run by Black Americans. The trustees were all white, way up at the tippy top. But like all the structure of everyday running these individual locations was, it was all Black men or Black people. Probably Black men.
Black men.
One thing is, opening all of these new branches so quickly really brought in even more deposits, opened new accounts, which was great, but it also depleted the bank's resources because they were opening so fast and they had just started.
Yeah.
The bank's original headquarters were in New York City.
So are they getting any government money?
I don't think so. The original headquarters of the bank was in New York City, but in 1865, they built a huge new headquarters building in Washington, D.C. Frederick Douglass wrote that its, quote, magnificent brownstone front, its towering height, its perfect appointments, and the fine display it made in the transaction of its business was a sight I had never expected to see.
Mm.
But building this building cost more than $200,000 in its construction and furnishing.
Okay.
More than $4 million in today's money.
Whoa.
And all of that spending so early after they had just got set up was kind of just the beginning of the trouble that was to come. And on that note, I think it's time to take a little break.
Yes.
I'm very much enjoying this drink, and I might need another. Need continued whistle wedding juice. Whew. All right, we'll be right back.
Take 9 plus 10 and we're live.
Let's get it, fam.
I'm one of your hosts, Hamish Lakhmi.
And I'm your other host, Aaron Conway.
And welcome to our show, The Third Wheel.
You know when you like crush on someone, you just sometimes act a bit like silly in front of them?
Pop, pop, Aaron.
You guys just roast each other.
Those are ugly topics to talk about and they're really uncomfortable. Being out of your comfort zone is where the growth happens.
There were children who were carrying guns to school. Children as in like 13 to 16 year olds. They used to carry guns to school. There were teachers who came before us who had been shot dead by the students.
I've realized significantly since before meditating and after meditating how much more I just notice things around me and realize things, and it makes life a lot more just Beautiful.
So I live in between the seafood market where it's supposed to have first originated and the hospital where it was first sort of confirmed and diagnosed.
Like jumping on this podcast, the third wheel. I love being the third wheel right now. It's fantastic.
Okay, we're back with new juleps. New lips.
Yes. It is.
Deliciosity.
It's the scientific term.
Yes. I love a cocktail with a good deliciosity ratio.
Trying to do it this time without my toilet paper. I mean, it's not toilet
tissue.
Paper. Tissue.
Stephanie's just sitting with a roll of toilet paper wrapping her cocktail up like a mummy.
I mean, that's what it looked like. Oh, yeah. This is so good.
It's so good. I think the cognac really does, like, it's better than bourbon.
Yeah.
It's like sort of floral really almost. It tastes like fruity.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Okay, so one of the biggest issues facing the Freedman's Bank, obviously, who didn't see this coming, was the all-white board of trustees. They had very little incentive to actually govern this bank.
Yeah.
While the bank's president, John Elvard, certainly wanted to see the bank flourish and do well, most of the other trustees didn't give a single fuck.
Yeah, and he's one of 50.
Exactly, yeah. Many of them didn't really have anything to do with the bank at all.
Oh.
And some of them...
What are they doing there?
They're on the board, but that doesn't mean they're actually going to board meetings and doing anything. Some of them later said that they never had even agreed to be on the board. They were just like... Someone was like, hey, that guy's a banker. Let's throw him on the board. And they didn't even know.
What? What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly.
Whoa.
And of course, there were no penal clauses in the charter that established the bank, so the trustees weren't personally liable if the bank struggled or failed. They had no incentive
to make it do well. No financial stakes
in it. Exactly.
Yeah, it's not like they own shares in it.
Nope.
Oh, no.
And the bank's charter was also ambiguous on how deposits could be used. While 2/3 of the bank's deposits were required to be invested in U.S. government securities, the remaining available funds did not have any specific restrictions, except for one. There was one very clear rule against lending. But in 1870, the board convinced Congress to change that rule and allow loans and high-risk investments real estate.
Oh, no.
Yes. And the board never even notified the customers that the charter had been changed when it was changed. Never even told anyone. The Washington Post later wrote that one senator had, quote, warned the Senate and the House that such a step would surely mark the beginning of the end of the Freedman's Bank. In the speech, he told them about his experience with banks who invested in real estate development and had a really hard time getting any returns out of it and struggled.
Yeah.
In his speech, he said, quote, there would unquestionably be made bad investments and that the institution would surely be bankrupted. And this article went on to say that the power in
It's like he had eyes.
Exactly.
Yes. He wouldn't even need a crystal ball. It's like he had eyes.
Uh-huh. The article said that the power and influence of real estate speculators was too strong and they won out in the end. So Congress was like, sure, let's let them do real estate speculation. We love it. We love to see it. Congress did, however, put rules on what kinds of loans and investments could be chosen or allowed, and made rules on how to ensure their safety and stability of these loans, but they never checked to make sure these rules were being followed.
Oh, no!
Yes. Many of the loans were being made to companies that were owned or operated by the bank's board of trustees or by men on the board.
Wow, I'm so shocked
to hear that. Yes, or their friends. Yeah,
their buddies.
And other trustees were simply using the Freedman's Bank as a way to offload the liabilities of other banks that they owned or operated or sat on the boards of.
What?
They were just like, we'll sell you this piece of property that is like
a total
piece of garbage. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Like, we know that this is going to be bad for us, that it's not going well. So let's sell it to the Freedman's Bank. It's fine. A top dollar because I'm on the board so I can set the price we'll pay for it.
Oh my God. Wow.
And it later turned out that the bank was also investing in risky real estate bonds before the charter had even been amended. They weren't allowed to do this, but one was checking.
Yeah.
Then, in the spring of 1873, a series of events, including the crash of the Vienna Stock Exchange, triggered a worldwide financial panic. Many of the bank's investments failed, and the bank became increasingly unstable. The New York Stock Exchange closed for several days in the fall after this panic, and there was a run on banks across the country. Depositors were running into their bank, withdrawing their savings in a panic. And the Freedman's Bank was no different, except for the fact that people couldn't take all of their money out.
Oh, no.
So in March of 1874, in an effort to restore and maintain the confidence of their depositors, bank officials voted to replace John Elvert as president and elected Frederick Douglass in his place.
Okay.
Unaware of how bad things really were, Douglass invested $10,000 of his own money. In 1874 money, $10,000 of his own money to demonstrate his faith in the bank's future. Of this change in leadership, one historian at the time wrote, "Some, looking for a scapegoat, were anxious that colored officials be in charge when the bank failed, as they were sure it would. Others thought that a Negro administration would restore the confidence of the depositors and enable the institution to survive until better times." But it was too late for that. It was too late to survive until better times.
It was a sinking ship.
Yes. Between the bad investments they've made, the terrible economic panic, the failure of several railroads and other banks that they had invested in. The problems.
All of the fraud, the things that were being sold that were garbage.
Yeah, mismanagement, abuse, and literally outright fraud by the Board of Trustees. And the expansion efforts, all of these new buildings that they had just put up.
Yeah.
It was too much. The Freedman's Bank was on the brink of collapse.
Oh, my God.
Frederick Douglass begged Congress to intervene, but after a few months assessing the bank's finances, he realized that he was, quote, married to a corpse, and he recommended to Congress that the bank be closed. A few of the trustees were investigated, but all were found innocent of any wrongdoing.
Of course. I'm surprised they even investigated. I know. Okay, that's cute.
I'm sure that they were like, we're investigating.
Yeah.
You're fine.
You're fine.
As I mentioned before, the FDIC didn't exist until 1933. But Congress was worried about, like, a race riot, essentially. They were worried that, you know, these people had just gotten their freedom, and then the government was like, here's all your money, sorry. Poof. It's, you know. So they decided that they had to try to reimburse the bank's customers up to 62 cents on every dollar lost. Unfortunately, it looks like this move was mostly meant to look good on paper rather than be good in practice.
Yeah.
And most people weren't able to collect even that 62 cents on the dollar.
I didn't think so. Yeah.
Bank commissioners decided to put the burden of proof of how much you had in your bank account on account holders rather than just looking at bank records.
What?
To apply for repayment.
That's garbage.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so dastardly.
It's so fun. Like, it's very cynical. Records. It's like they didn't want
to give their money back.
They just wanted to put up as many obstacles as possible to paying out.
It's the story of the Reconstruction.
Absolutely.
It's like, here, you're going to be free. You're just like us, but also let's lie.
Exactly.
And pretend and make it as difficult as possible.
Let you think that you're becoming a functional member of this society that we say is so great.
Yes.
But then we're going to do everything in our power to stop you from actually taking advantage of the benefits of that. To apply for repayment, depositors had to use their own personal bank passbooks to prove how much they had in their accounts. But this wasn't even something you could just go down to the local branch and show them your passbook. Depositors had to mail their passbooks to Washington to submit a claim.
Uh-oh.
And many people were afraid to do this. The bank clearly proved that they weren't great at managing other people's money.
That's such a bad idea.
Yes. And if the passbook was lost or misplaced in the mail, you're shit out of luck. That's it. It's gone. You can never get it back.
Oh, no.
And that's your only way to get anything. Other people had to hire lawyers to prove their identities or their relationships to depositors who had died to get their relatives' money out of the bank.
Of course.
And then, even if you could, even if you mailed your passbook, you proved your identity,
jumped over all the hurdles,
the bank didn't even start returning any of the deposits until November of 1875, over a year after it failed.
surprise, you have no money for a year.
Yeah, it failed in June of 1874. November 1875, they're like, okay, we'll start issuing payments now. It took so long that some depositors completely lost faith in this bank and were so desperate for money that they decided to start selling their claims against the bank to their like grocers or store owners, store clerks, for a fraction of their value. I read about one person in New Orleans who had $352 in his account and sold his passbook for $28.16.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And only about half of account holders ever received any payment back. And most of those were wealthier depositors who had access to like a lawyer or someone that could help them through this process and make sure that they got their money back.
Yeah.
Some depositors and their descendants spent more than 30 years petitioning Congress for reimbursement, but Congress refused to ever take any responsibility. This was a private corporation. They had nothing to do with it, even though their name was plastered across every single fucking piece of bank literature.
Yeah.
The moral of the story here is that rich white men ruin everything.
I will drink to that.
Yes. The Freedmen's Bank was set up with the best of intentions and really could have been an incredible resource.
Yeah, it was so necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. For these formerly enslaved Black Americans to build generational wealth and fight their way to the top.
Yeah.
But they put rich white men at the top instead, and they used the bank as their own personal money laundering front. One positive thing that did come out of the bank is that it created a wealth of records that future generations have been able to look back to for information about their ancestors and their lineage, their heritage.
Okay.
The data and the data collected by the bank, in many cases, pretty much to set up an account, you had to include the account holder's name, their birthplace, residence, age, employer, names of their family members, and often even whether the account holder was light or dark skinned. And in
that's
some cases.
So American.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my God. Wow. On so, this color chart.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Yes.
Are you coffee, closer to coffee or mocha?
Are you having a bad day or are you a terrorist? Some records even contained information on the names of former enslavers.
I just got that.
Oh.
If you're closer to khaki, we know who you are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So some of the records that the bank collected even contained the names of former enslavers and the names of the plantations that these.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Which is like.
That's great.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The bank's records of 480,000 names are said to be the largest single repository of lineage-linked African-American records in history.
Wow.
Which is a huge deal.
Yeah. If there's ever reparations, you know, 400 years from now, that'll be good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, not only do they know, exactly, not only do they know the names of their ancestors, but also the names of those who enslaved them.
Yeah.
In some cases, not all, but yeah. In 2001, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints digitized the records from 28 of the bank's branches. So this information is online for the public at familysearch.org.
Okay. The Mormons just had their own.
I don't know why.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
They don't like Black people. I don't understand why this is. They don't have.
Yeah. This is mysterious.
But that's what they did.
Okay.
But even though these records are priceless for many Black families in this country, the collapse of the Freedmen's Bank devastated tens of thousands of Black Americans and impacted generation after generation of their ancestors.
Yeah. It's like after 300 years of bondage, they're like, we've done it. We've made it. We've arrived. Yeah, we can finally start building wealth like our light-skinned countrymen, fellow countrymen. But yeah, no.
Yeah.
Not so fast.
After only 9 years after opening, the Freedmen's Bank officially closed on June 29th, 1874.
That is so sad.
On the date of closing, they owed almost $3 million to 61,144 depositors. Some people had already gotten out because of the financial panic, but there were 61,000 depositors left.
Damn.
In today's dollars, they owed almost $73 million to these 61,000 people. Many of these people were left with absolutely nothing after a decade of saving and fighting to build new lives for themselves and their families during Reconstruction.
Oh.
And that loss of savings and wealth not only impoverished thousands, but also left bitter feelings of betrayal, abandonment, and distrust of the American banking system, And that distrust persists to this day. Some historians say that to Black Americans, the Freedmen's Bank collapse is to banking and finance what the Tuskegee experiments are to healthcare.
Yet, like, the loudest voice, the loudest, like, anti-government voice are just, like, rich white men.
Uh-huh. I don't want any interference in my affairs.
Taxes. Yeah. This is oppression.
Combined with persisting pay disparities, predatory lending, a history of redlining that barred Black people from living in certain neighborhoods or generating generational wealth, it's no wonder that there is a drastic wealth gap between Black and white Americans that exists to this day.
Well, wealth compounds over time.
Yeah.
If you're able to build generational wealth starting in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, like, 100%. There's no way to compete.
Exactly. Yeah. Black Americans were never given a chance.
Yeah. Until, or reparations. Like, yeah, exactly. Happened in other places. Yeah. But yeah.
According to the Brookings Institute, in 2016, in America, white families had an average net worth of $171,000.
Wow.
The average white family.
Holy shit.
The average net worth of Black families at the same time was $17,150. Literally one-tenth of that of white families in America.
Yeah.
One-tenth. And it's no fucking wonder.
Yeah. Wait, cause and effect? I mean, wait.
Causes are linked to effects? I need to do my own research.
There you go. There you go. Okay, that was a great story. I had heard whisperings about the Freedmen's Bank. I knew it was Bad News Bears, so I did not look into it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that explains a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
9 years. It only took nine years. That's heartbreaking.
I'm surprised it took that long for some rich white men to do some fuckery.
Yeah, that was a lot. But really,
at least we had a tasty drink.
Yeah, at least it is so good.
Mm-hmm.
I still have a decent amount of it.
But this is why it's important to talk about American history.
Yeah.
This is why we should be telling these stories not just in Black History Month, first of all, but also...
It's American history.
Yeah. The idea of this whole... All these anti-CRT bills that you're not even allowed to talk about Black history at all.
Yeah.
Because it might upset some white children. How are people supposed to see the cause and effect? Like...
They're not supposed to.
Exactly.
They're not supposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason why, like... authoritative regimes and like fascist countries, they burn books.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want people to know. And that's where we are today.
We just
unfortunately.
Ban books.
Yeah. Oh my God. That article you sent me about how there are apparently private companies trying to take over public libraries.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
It's Tim sent that to me.
And then I
sent it to Stephanie.
Yeah. I started to read it and I'm just like, okay. I'm going to read this later because I am already so upset.
It's not even very dense. There's not a lot of information. It's just somebody found out that this is happening and is like trying to put it out there.
Yeah.
Hopefully somebody will really do a deep dive on it and expose this. But like, we need public libraries.
Yeah.
Because we're not teaching this shit in schools. So people need access to this information.
And they're
somehow
getting rid of like these privatized, formerly public libraries. They're getting rid of their librarians. Who have like master's degrees in library science because I guess this is how they're cost saving.
Yeah.
They're just hiring people who aren't salaried and just minimum wage at a library.
Yeah, you have to get so much schooling to become a librarian.
You have to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
It's so mind-boggling that this is happening. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be shocked, but like...
They already don't make any money.
But it's not about the money. It's like they...
Sure, but...
They want to be able to control what's in that library. And I think a librarian, like a proper one, would fight that.
Exactly.
They'd be like, no, we're not...
This is a library.
Yeah! We need to learn our history so we can stop repeating it.
Exactly. Cheers to that.
Yeah. So our drinks are empty. So I guess we're done. America's history is juicy. We just add a shit ton of brown liquor and some sugar and some muddled lime, muddled mint, Jesus.
A hint of mint.
A hint of mint. Thank you so much to oh my God.
Oh, this next story is going to be good.
Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lurzel.
Oh no!
I twisted your arm from the cocktail.
You did. You set me up. Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather. We could not do this without him.
We could not.
We could not.
Oh my God. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.